Stay tuned for The Lin Show. Today, I'm rebroadcasting the first part of an interview I did with Andrei Maleev-Babel, in which he describes his remarkable journey, that is, emigrating as an adult, albeit an already talented, successful theater professional, from Russia, his home, to the United States, where he barely spoke the language, acting professor for the first-year students at FSU Conservatory for Actor Training, and also director of the production in which the second-year students perform. Andrei will talk about his... In this interview, Andrei will talk about that remarkable journey and also about the production which he is currently directing, that of A View from the Bridge, opening soon in the Cook Theater.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
Hello, and welcome to The Lin Show. The Lin Show is about being the person you really are. As I always say, it's not about being the person you think you're supposed to be, or the person people tell you you should be, or not being the person other people are, or even the person that someone told you you had to be, but the person you really are, which in the case of many too many of us is not the same. As a therapist, it's clear to me that many of us are acting out a person who is not the entire truth of us. And The Lin Show is about saying that if this is true for you, if there are parts of you for which you are in denial or simply hiding, it may not be too late to recapture the entire you and be that person. When you are the person you really are, life is much more comfortable. In my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do this because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And Andrei Malayev Babel is such a person. You can hear in his commitment to the work he does and in the way he pursued it. So, as I said in the run-up, you will hear Andrei's remarkable story, and then you will hear him talk about the production he's currently directing, that of A View from the Bridge, and that is a really interesting discussion. So here now, Andrei Malayev Babel.
I am here with Andrei Malayev Babel in his office in the Oslo building to talk to him about the play he is directing. But let me explain to you that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Clearly you are doing that. And I always ask the same question, and that is, how did the art capture you? How did it happen?
But just the atmosphere in which I grew up was very artistic. Because my grandfather was a writer, my grandmother was working, getting his works published, and writing memoirs about him. There were lots of kind of friends at the house constantly who were either writers or actors or directors or artists. My mother was an architect. So the atmosphere, as you see, was very artistic.
And where did you grow up?
In Moscow. Uh-huh. In Moscow, and in Russia's capital, at that point the capital of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is how it all started. So there were lots of inspiration. I was taken to concerts, musical theater, you know, drama theater.
So the whole idea of being a creative and artistic person, I mean, it's almost as though one wouldn't have come out of that soup as something else?
Probably not. I mean, literature would have been another avenue, perhaps, but now I'm writing, but you see, I'm writing about theater, or I'm writing adaptations of plays. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing different things. I studied music, and I still continue working with music, but it's music for the theater. Uh-huh. If I write, it's about the theater, or for the theater. I act, direct, I teach. So you see, I do
it's
many
all the
things,
theater,
yes, but they're all dedicated to the theater.
Well, okay, so how did that happen, the love affair with the theater?
It's difficult to say, but, you know, it started very early because, as all of the kind of children who grow up to be actors, I was doing some kind of domestic performances at a very early age, puppet theater, which is also very traditional. I was also directing because there were these performances that usually were connected with birthday parties. And guests would come, and inspired by one family tradition that I observe, I would write a play, which was usually a parody, a burlesque on some famous fairy tale or something. I'd write music for it, I would like songs, would write songs for it, and I would direct the guests, who were all obviously adults, and yeah. I was a little kid, I would direct them in this performance.
How old were you when you started doing this?
Oh, I don't know, probably we are talking about 12 years old, uh-huh. Something like that.
Yes.
So I would direct them, and then they would basically perform this at the end of the party.
They would indulge you?
They would absolutely indulge me, and for quite a while, actually, because of how early I started directing, mm-hmm. I was working with actors who were sometimes significantly older than I was.
Yes, but you had the permission, the encouragement, I don't know what the word is, that it wasn't a stretch, of course, he can do this.
I was surprised, but yes, I did get that permission, and nobody ever really doubted me because of my age.
Right. Nobody said, who do you think you are, or what do you think you're doing, or
any of that. No, for some reason, people kind of went along.
Yeah.
Probably long before I knew what I was really doing.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, they kind of went along. Yes,
I'm sure that's right. And that is such an incredible gift to someone who's, whatever it is you're going to do, if people start right off telling you that you have the right to do it, that you're good at it, that you know, I mean, at the beginning, no one ever really is, so, but to get that right off the bat,
yeah.
There's no struggle attached.
Yeah, to get that acceptance.
Yes.
I wouldn't say that I had to seriously fight for it, because when I entered theater school in Moscow, I entered on the directing track, and I was 19. And all of my fellow students were in their 30s or even 40s, because the idea was in Russia, at least the idea is that if you are training to be a director, you need to have had some professional experience and certainly have certain knowledge of life.
Oh my God. So how did you...
I don't know. I was the only probably person in the history of that school, at least, you know, as far as I'm aware, who was accepted onto the directing track at that age.
And did you know at the time how unusual that was?
Yes, I did. I was trying to actually enter on a more typical kind of, for my age, acting track.
Right, so that you could get the acting and the life behind you.
Of course, and I would enjoy it. And I continued acting and I act still. Mm-hmm. Right, but that's not wasn't the emphasis of my training. And thankfully, the Russian idea of training directors is that they have to go through the entire acting program.
Yes.
And then on top of it, they have to learn to direct, because, you know, you're ending up working with actors, so you might as well know how actors
what
work.
What a concept.
What a concept, exactly.
So were you doing them at the same time?
It was the program for directors, but acting classes were just part of the curriculum.
Yeah,
in addition to directing, the history of theater, the history of art, and other subjects.
You loved them all.
Especially studying the communist science, because we're talking about the 1980s.
So what is the communist science?
Well, it's whatever Marx said and wrote and Lenin and so on. So all these subjects are no longer taught in Russian theater schools or any other schools for that matter.
But you know them.
But there was such a, well, it would be a huge exaggeration. I mean, nobody really held us kind of responsible to knowing this, but it was so-called scientific communism. Can you imagine?
No.
There is such thing as scientific communism.
Yes.
So that's what it was in the history of the Communist Party and, you know, things that.
But these are required subjects.
The required subjects until after the time of perestroika, obviously, you know, and I was... You know, in school.
You were before that.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you, at 19, with this huge block of experience behind you, already have written and acted and directed, really, essentially, most of your life, right? You go to school and you... Now, did you think you had to unlearn stuff? I mean, were you stubborn or were you open? Was it easy for you? Do you know what I mean?
I was open. I think that I wasn't a very good student because certain things came easy to me. And I think a lot of things I did just to satisfy the requirement. Unfortunately, this student mentality is not uncommon. And now that I work with students a lot,
you know,
of course they recognize it.
Yeah.
You know, and I do realize that there's a lot of things that I thought I understood and I didn't really. And I think that this is something that's, again, very common.
That was the that's actually the question I was asking. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's very common. I think it's especially common, well, maybe this is an exaggeration or maybe this is a myth. But in order to be an actor, you really do have to believe that you have something to offer, that you know something, right? You can't get up there, you know.
You better have the sense of purpose behind this. Why you are doing it, what it is that you are either trying to contribute, or at least what it is that you cannot help but express. Cannot help but say
audience. Yes. So maybe this isn't true, but it seems to me, just talking to you, that that pretty much... all of the people who do this will come to learning with a kind of sense, I already know this. Is that wrong?
In contemporary situation, yes, because especially if we are talking about graduate school, usually people come to the graduate acting training program like ours with some undergraduate background.
Yes.
And it usually is in theater and in acting. But if you really look at how popular the art of acting is nowadays, and we have programs like the Actor Studio or some other programs where actors constantly talk about their art.
Right.
So I think that even when you come to the undergraduate program, you already have formed certain ideas. You heard something at least about method. You heard some actors interviewed. They told you exactly how
they did it.
And so you already come with certain idea. Probably, maybe you were taking theater classes in high school.
Right.
Lots of high schools have theater and acting classes nowadays.
Yes.
So really, I don't think that we are coming as a clean slate, which used to be the case with the actors of the old times, before Stanislavski, before the schools of acting,
yes.
where actors really came as a clean slate and they were immediately thrown into practice, and they failed and failed and failed until they succeeded, unless they had this extraordinary gift.
Kind of natural.
So that is where I think we are at certain disadvantage, because depending, of course, on what it is that you heard, on what it is that you've been exposed to, once you enter, let's say, a conservatory or even undergraduate program that has very particular set of beliefs, you may have to unlearn. You may already have to actually kind of be prepared for a certain turnaround instead of just absorbing what you are given.
Yes, and I imagine that's difficult to do. Maybe this isn't true, but I imagine that is difficult
for actors. Unlearning is much more difficult than learning.
Well, just as a general rule it is, but I would think for actors it's even more difficult. Because it's their very self. It's not something, it's not something they're writing on a pad. Or,
yes, it is. It's their body, their nerves, their imagination, their feelings. It's them.
Yeah, that's right. And then, and people are observing it.
Yes.
So So imagine it's quite difficult if you've already decided this is right for me, this is how I should do it, and then to have to undo
that. And I'm not even talking about how accessible all kinds of movies and TV programs are today. So these young people, they have seen movies from the 30s, from the 40s, contemporary movies, soap operas,
right?
It's TV shows and so on, and every time it's some kind of a very different style of acting.
Yes.
And very different way of kind of living on stage or living on the screen, right?
Yeah.
Or just performing. So I think already this influence is there. They're copying a favorite actor, for example, and their style and so on.
Yes, yes.
And so there's a lot there already, which I suppose usually is not hugely helpful.
No, I'm sure that's correct. Okay, so now we're a little ahead of where I want to follow this line, but I want to go back. So at 19, was that true of you?
Yes, definitely, definitely, because I was very much enamored with certain style of acting and certain actors who probably would be called character actors. And the art of physical characterization, external characterization, actually is really disappearing from contemporary theater to a certain degree. Actors are much more likely to be more or less remaining themselves physically and being cast for their types rather than for their ability to be a chameleon,
something.
To become something.
Yes.
So we go to see a star because that star is predictable, because that star is mostly doing what they're doing, and that's what we kind of love about that star. In terms of transformation, well, this is usually kind of left to a makeup artist or something. Or sometimes we don't even ask for transformation. And I think that this style of acting was probably something that I really loved, because I loved these chameleons that I saw. But it's a very particular style and also a very different process, ultimately, that probably is not kind of a good thing to have as your starting point.
You grow into it. But this is the story of your life. You are starting at the top everywhere.
Yeah.
So this is just more of that, right?
Probably.
So what did they do with you, with this pipsqueak who came in with this idea about character
acting?
Well,
I think that they brought us back to the truth, back to I am, so that you're not even playing any character. But, of course, that's also deceiving, because if you understand it literally, and you decide that, so first I need to learn how to just be myself on stage,
yes.
That's also not true, because, of course, whenever the circumstances of your character's life are different from your circumstances,
then you can't be yourself.
You can't be yourself.
Right.
You have to transform.
Right.
So this whole idea that this is really you is nothing but a pedagogical tactic. But if you really believe in it, I think you're also going to get stuck with the idea that, oh, I actually don't need to transform.
Yes.
Right? But transformation happens from day one. Without transformation, without the work of imagination, where you suddenly find yourself in a different situation and therefore certain different aspects of you come out,
yes,
aspects that maybe don't usually come out in everyday life. Without that idea, you also don't have a very clear vision of the process, because the process is you got to become different, even though you also cannot become entirely different so that you lose yourself in it. So you have to remain yourself while becoming different, and that's the contradiction number one, which is very difficult for actors to really understand.
Yes.
Finally, if you don't become different, then you will never be able to experience what the character experiences ultimately. Without transformation, you will not have access to your artistic emotions.
And it won't work. It won't be real. We won't believe it.
No.
Right.
So transformation and experience, emotional experience, go together, actually.
Okay, so that's what they tried to help you learn, or did help you learn, or focused on
for
you?
I think that probably the approach to acting, considering that we were really training as directors, was a little bit of a shortcut approach. And we were trained, and we even had, you know, a full-blown production that we performed as actors at the end of our training. But I think that we were always looked upon, they kind of cut us a slack, so to speak.
Hmm.
They didn't use the same measures with us as they used with those who were on the acting track. We were supposed to be training as directors.
Yes.
And as long as we are passable actors, I think they were absolutely satisfied.
Okay,
you know,
I got
the standards were different.
I see. So you skipped a step.
Yes, and then I was really discovering myself as an actor later in my career after I have graduated
as a director. Okay, so then what happened? So
and
now you're graduating as a director younger than anybody, right?
Yes, by that time I already had an amateur theater company that I organized and was running for a while.
I see.
I was doing it parallel to my training. And then finally this theater company, after I graduated, became my first priority, and the company developed into a professional company. It was one of the first private theater companies in Russia after Perestroika. Because before Perestroika you couldn't start anything.
No, no, no.
It doesn't matter.
No, no, no,
it doesn't
matter
what it is.
Right.
You know, whether it's a grocery shop or theater company, nothing could be
No,
profitable.
No.
Yeah. So because of the shifts in the policy, we were actually able to, incorporate.
Perfect timing for you.
It was a
You're standing on the edge with this thing ready to go the minute, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I worked with this company for about 8 years, and it's during these 8 years that I had a co-director who is now, in Russian TV business. He's a producer and host with Russian TV. And together we were kind of leading this company. He was directing, I was directing, I was acting, he acted occasionally, but he also took care of all the management, which right now I understand that I should really be bowing before him for having taken that load off of my shoulders. And this company worked mostly with classical plays, but not your kind of, again, we talked about household names. There were not household name classics. There were less known classical authors.
Yes.
So, and then ultimately we traveled all over Russia, or what was Soviet Union at that time. We traveled extensively. We performed in Moscow. And we started an exchange program with two theater companies from the United States by the early 90s. And it's basically at that point that I came on an exchange, on a cultural exchange program, I came to the United States.
When was that?
That was 91.
Wow. Wow. And so here you are. So can you say how that happened?
That happened because My aunt actually lived in Washington, D.C. She was a friend with a university professor through her husband. And this university professor working at the University of Maryland, he knew these actors who were very much interested in Russian theatrical tradition because part of their training was supposed to be Stanislavski's based. So they wanted to learn more.
Yeah.
And when this university professor, who was a professor of sociology, his name was John Robinson, he was a Russian sociologist, so he came to Russia frequently. He got to see our productions, he liked them, and he said, you really need to connect with my theater friends in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started simply going and visiting each other. Again, this was perestroika time.
Yes, yes, yes.
So it became possible. The
yes.
Iron Curtain was lifted.
Yes.
Something like this would have been
Never.
Entirely impossible.
Yeah.
I, you know, let's say in the early 80s, it would have been impossible. Even in the mid-80s, it was problematic. But by late 80s, early 90s, it became possible. So what happened then, it was kind of, we come and see you come and see us, and then I said, how long are we going to be going and seeing each other? Let's produce something together. So I really started trouble. And we did produce two productions, one classical Russian farce, another classical American farce. We rehearsed it in Moscow and showed it in Moscow. And then we rehearsed...
Both of them.
We rehearsed them it further in L.A., and we showed them in L.A.
Where?
It's an old historic theater called Heliotrope Theater.
Yes, I know it.
So...
Did you do the Russian play in Russian?
Russian actors in Russian, American actors in English. It was a bilingual production.
Wow.
Which was another very kind of bold step.
Yeah, no kidding.
So that's how we kind of stirred trouble and brought this collaboration further than just cultural exchange.
Yes, yes,
because
yes.
cultural exchange is usually just mutual visits.
Right, and hello, goodbye.
Hello, goodbye.
Right.
So that was a huge thing that we did. Actually.
So then... I mean, somehow you wound up here.
Yes, I mean, it happened for two reasons, and one reason, which is very important reason, is my wife. I met my wife on my first trip to D.C. She was in the sociology class led by that very professor of sociology, John Robinson, that I told you about. And she came to class late that day. She was considering skipping class, but then said, okay, these two Russian actors are going to be our guest speakers. So that's curious. So she at the last moment she decided to make the class, and she came in late, and the only free seat was smack in the first row. So needless to say, she attracted attention, and I approached her after the class. And at that point, I think my English was still pretty bad. I was almost kind of approaching her through my interpreter.
So you went up to this woman and you couldn't really talk to?
I couldn't really talk to her the way that I would, kind of as freely as I wanted
yeah.
to. And then gradually we went to the theater together and we met on other occasions. And that was still the trip where I was just enjoying, you know, watching theater and sightseeing and so on. And then on the last night in D.C., I asked her if she would come to Moscow, and she said that she would, and she actually did, which was her first trip away from home, I think, in any direction.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So and she certainly didn't speak any Russian.
And she didn't speak any Russian, so she was there really at my mercy. So that was very brave of her to do it. So, and kind of the rest is history.
It's history, exactly right. Well, and then when you two realized, whatever, that you wanted to be together, I guess there was no chance she was going to go live in Moscow.
Well, you guessed that right. I was inviting her and asking her that she, you know, that she would consider. But yes, my wife Lisa, she said no. She wasn't interested in living in Russia. And at the same time, it was interesting because my career in the States was kind of developing because it was a very strange period in Russia where audience stopped going to the theater. And you probably know Russian theatrical culture and how important theater is
yes.
in Russian cultural
yes.
tradition. But it was very difficult period of the early 90s where there were such great hardships, and people were so depressed. Theaters also weren't doing exactly what they were, should have been doing, but they were staging all of this depressing...
I was going to say they weren't doing comedy.
...about how tough your life is.
See, in America, in the Depression, we knew better, and we had all those wonderful comedies, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. But I understand why it happened, you see, because there are so many topics that were forbidden. That when suddenly it was allowed to talk about contemporary problems and hardships and social ills, right?
They wanted to
do it. And audiences had so much of it kind of in their own front yard.
Right, exactly. Right.
That they just refused to go. So it all fortunately reversed because theaters understood that they need to do classics.
Right.
And audiences immediately came back as long as, you know, as soon as theater started doing classics, and by that time, however, I was already actually teaching at the Catholic University of America in D.C. at the drama department. I was first a resident director at the Chamber Theater, which was a D.C. company, and then I was, you know, doing lots of classes also in D.C., training actors, and actually, in 98, I started my own theater company in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So it kind of so happened that I was really able, obviously,
with
the support of my family, my wife, I was able to make a life here as a theater professional, which I must say is very rare.
No kidding.
Let's face it, most of the people who immigrate do not end up working in the field that they trained in.
Not only most of the people who emigrate, most of the people who decide they want to be in theater in the United States don't wind up working in their chosen career.
That unfortunately is also...
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think it speaks probably to your talent, your skill, and your perseverance.
Simply because of what we talked about earlier. The fact that I am able to do so many things in the theatrical field.
Yes.
Because maybe if I could only do one thing,
yes,
I would not have made it.
Yes.
But because I can teach and I can act and I can direct, you know,
yes,
and now I write about theater,
yes,
maybe this is what's kind of helping me to stick to theater and not to have to do
You can have
things.
That if you like. I think it's probably talent, skill, and perseverance myself.
All right, well, I was learned to always take credit, so I'll take credit.
Yes, yes. And you know, to go back, I really believe that early experience of you can do it, you should do it, we want you to do it, we like it that you do it, that never leaves you. That's becomes a part of how you feel about yourself, and you present that wherever you go. You present, oh, you should want me, you're going to want me, you know, and I think that that's...
I think that this is what was driving me for quite a while. I mean, every artist hits a certain crisis point, and I think that probably I also at some point while in D.C. hit that crisis point where I was actually beginning to doubt. I don't know if it was I was doubting myself or was I doubting that I can continue developing and grow in that particular environment. But you are right. I think for quite a long time I was driven by the license kind of and the support.
That's exactly right. That is exactly the kind of word I was looking for.
Yeah.
So how did you wind up in Sarasota, Florida?
Well, I was... It's the magic number 8 because I was... my theater company in Moscow existed for 8 years, and my DC theater company, which was very successful and won lots of Helen Hayes awards and nominations and was embraced by the community, by the kind of theater going audience and also by the press, also existed for 8 years. This is where I have to go back to the time in Moscow where I was running a theater company as co-artistic director, but I didn't have to lift my finger.
Yes, because you had a manager.
To fundraise, let's say. Yes. Or to even worry about, you know, how we're going to get paid at the end of the month.
Yes.
And not to mention all of the administrative work and so on. So that is something that I certainly got a full taste of in D.C. because I was producing artistic director, so not only was I, you know, directing and acting in some of the productions and, you know, in charge of the repertoire and casting, I was also in charge of the entire administrative operation and fundraising.
Oy.
Which is absolutely oy. So again, the people who know how to do it and people who have talent to do it and people who enjoy doing it earned my respect.
God bless them.
God bless them. And God bless the people who give to the arts. But let's face it, it's not easy.
No.
Especially when you are at the same time running, you know, running artistic kind of operations. So, or trying to continue developing as an artist. So 8 years was kind of enough.
Right.
And I said that I think that by now the managing part of it is really beginning to affect, is really beginning to affect how I develop as an artist. I also missed teaching because I was teaching at the Catholic University of America for quite a while, but eventually the company took priority.
Yeah.
I was teaching there for 2 years as a full-time professor, and then I continued teaching beyond that, actually, doing very different classes for a while, but I was missing a formal training, because our training at the theater was actually all dedicated to productions. We tried to do formal training, but then a deadline would come, and we'd start training actors
just for the part,
for the demands of this production.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Be it the part, or be it particular, you know, technique that they had to do it, because a lot of this theater was movement oriented. There was a lot of movement, dance, singing, pantomime. So it was really a theater of synthesis, where drama coexisted with the arts. So at that point, I felt that I would like to do teaching full-time again. And I would like to continue doing theater projects in my spare time, which I do.
Right.
But I really wanted to get back to teaching full-time.
And you wanted to stop fundraising.
And I wanted to stop fundraising badly, yes.
Yeah.
And I applied for this position, and I was so fortunate that the opening came.
What is this position?
It's a first-year acting professor, acting teacher. So I teach actors in their first year at the conservatory, and I direct in the second year. I direct one of the productions in the second year.
Well, let's talk about that now. So
there are two views from the bridge. It played on Broadway, paired with another one act that he has written, and it wasn't a success. And so a couple of years later, he rewrote it into a full-length play, which we are working with. And he got Peter Brook to stage it in London. It was a huge hit. And then it was staged by Peter Brook in Paris, also very successfully. And then it came back to Broadway and was a hit.
So do you know what was wrong with the first one or how he changed it?
Yes, definitely. The first one was much more bare bones. The story was not as fleshed out. But he liked it because it reminded him of Greek tragedy. Without all of the naturalistic details of character development, it was just a kind of a car wreck, you know, runaway train. It was something that just took off and without a lot of complications and nuances and details just went for that devastated finale. But as a result, it wasn't as, I guess, realistic as audience of that particular time period expected it to be. For one thing, the character of Eddie's wife, Beatrice, or Bea, was not nearly as prominent, so he extended it. So that character certainly won from this full-length version. Eddie is more or less the same. References to ancient Greece and Calabria and ancient Rome are much more prominent. And finally, the first version is in blank verse. You don't quite notice it because the language is still realistic. But of course, there is something there that makes it much more in tune with the Greek tragedy, which is what Arthur Miller is thinking about during this period. He's thinking common men are as tragic as Greek heroes and gods.
Yes.
And so he creates the death of a salesman. He creates a view from the bridge with the idea that these are tragic heroes, despite the fact that they're common men. So that is much more prominent in the first version of the play. The second version is different also because in the first version of the play, Eddie dies calling Catherine. In the second version of the play, he dies calling Beatrice.
Who's Catherine?
That niece that he is in love with, and whether he knows it or not, we are not quite sure. Whether he realizes it, he may not realize it himself. That a lot of these things he is doing to protect her and to keep her for himself, that lead to catastrophe ultimately, and his own demise, and breaks quite a few destinies. He may be doing out of love for her. That is not exactly a love that an uncle should feel for his niece, right? And it's her name that he calls out in the first version. The second version, he is dying with his wife's name on his lips.
And do you have an interpretation
about
why the one and then the other?
Absolutely.
Can you tell?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the second version, Miller makes it a much more complicated piece where love for the niece is unconscious. He is not aware of it. As far as he's concerned, he loves his wife. As far as he's concerned, you know, she's the woman for him. And in the first one, he is much more aware of the fact that he's in love with Catherine.
So in the second one, he's doing all this stuff, but he doesn't even know why.
He has no idea. Yeah. He's a much better man.
In the second one.
In the second one.
But there's also the question, well, the one that comes to my mind anyway, is that of the psychological aspect of it, that he's driven by things that he is not consciously aware of.
Yeah.
In the first play, in the one act, he's much more aware of himself. In the second one, so the second one is even more of a tragedy because it happens to him without his.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's tragic guilt, so to speak, right? He's guilty of it from a certain standpoint, right? But from other standpoint, he's innocent.
In Greek tragedy, the gods can do this to you. It's being done to him by something other than his own conscious awareness.
In the second version, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So again, closer to Greek tragedy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And interesting to me that Miller was so attached to this piece that he, even though it was not successful, that he went on and tried to do it again.
Oh, yes, because this piece is preceded by a screenplay, which is called Red Hook. And Red Hook is the area in Brooklyn where longshoremen and their families live and work. And he creates a screenplay, I think with Kazan, I'm pretty sure, about this guy, maybe it's Eddie from A View from the Bridge, maybe it's not, who goes against his fellow longshoreman, but in a different way that Eddie does. You know, Eddie ultimately reports one of the immigrants, and that creates a huge uproar in the community, and he's ostracized and so on. And the Red Hook screenplay is more of a trade union. It became on the waterfront. The Kazan and Miller parted ways over the witch hunt, over the McCarthy trials.
Really?
Yes, because Miller never named names and Kazan did. And so this is where they completely parted ways. They never spoke since, I think. And the screenplay was buried. And later Kazan rewrote it into what became On the Waterfront.
Wow. Mm. Did Miller get credit for that?
But it was sufficiently different so that, you know, it wasn't certainly a piece of plagiarism or anything.
Oh,
but, you know, but there is a connection. There's a very strong connection between the...
Well, and the basic story is pretty much...
It's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Pretty much it, yeah.
Wow.
So, needless to say, just as Crucible has a lot to do with the McCarthy era, A View from the Bridge also has a lot to do with that era, because when Eddie reports, you know, these young immigrants... When he names names,
right,
he ultimately commits that kind of...
And he pays for it.
And he pays for it, yeah.
But Kazan didn't pay for it.
Kazan didn't pay for it. He lived very long, prosperous life. But he lost his best friend. Miller and Kazan were best friends, both personally and also creatively. So that parting was probably a price to pay for Kazan.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And also, the idea of using Red Hook, using the longshoreman as the common man facing tragedy, captured both of them.
So
we got a view from the bridge and on the waterfront.
We've got the view from the bridge and on the waterfront, absolutely.
Right. Absolutely. Both of the men fascinated mm-hmm. with that
absolutely.
Idea.
But this is why Miller couldn't let go of the view from the bridge, which is why he wanted to lead it to some kind of completion. Because he said himself that when he wrote the one-act version, he wasn't even much aware of what was happening with him. It was kind of pouring out of him, and it was probably a sketch. You know how it is with artists. You know, the first thing that comes out is a sketch, and then you begin to elaborate on it. And for better or for worse, you got a full-blown painting. Sometimes the sketch is better, but for the most part, of course, the sketch is just a preparation for something more significant.
You're not usually doing this kind of contemporary piece for...
Well, if you call it contemporary, which of course it is, right?
Well, Miller is more contemporary
than Ibsen,
and Chekhov, right?
Yes, exactly, than Dostoevsky.
Yeah, right.
Right, and all of these other guys that I've been tackling. Yes, that's true. Much more contemporary. Because of the connection with the Greek tragedy, of course, I feel very much at home, right? I feel connected. And I must say that, as it very often happens with me, it was another production that kind of inspired me to tackle it.
Mm.
It certainly happened with A Woman from the Sea, which is an Ibsen piece that I did. I saw that play done in London at Arcola Theater, and I said, what a beautiful play, but what a completely wrong way of doing it. And that created kind of the impulse in me. In this case, I saw the Jan Wick production that he since then has been to Broadway, and it has been certainly televised and played in movie theaters. I mean, it's a very prominent production. So, and I basically saw it and I said, well, they certainly are right to find that parallel between this story and the Greek tragedy, and that is really wonderful. But they're looking for it in their own place. I mean, they're looking for it in the style of production, in the style of the set, in the style of acting. And they're completely stripping it of realism, right? They're putting it inside ultimately a bare box, which is like a boxing ring or something like that. And they're certainly making very, very strong point that this is a piece of tragedy and not a piece of naturalism.
Mm-hmm.
That point they actually make. But in doing so, they completely get rid of the other part of Miller, mm-hmm. which is realistic. He wants it to be seemingly realistic, and he wants underneath this realism, this blood of ancient Greek heroes pulsating in the veins of otherwise very common
people, modern
people, in this case longshoremen.
Yes, right? Yeah.
And of course with the British piece, they could be longshoremen, they could be anything else.
Right.
I mean, that wasn't really as important for them. And they created a marvelous production, you know, which design-wise I think is wonderful. There are some very good actors there, incredible actors like Michael Strong, for example. And at the same time, the fact that they're stripped completely of that realistic component is certainly making it something else rather than what Miller wrote. And so that was my impulse. To see a wonderful play, to realize, and also thanks to them, of course, to realize how much of a connection with the Greek tragedy there is, because
right.
they drove it home very clearly, and to see if something else can be done to keep that Greek tragedy, but at the same time to also honor the realism.
Do you want to tell us about the plot?
It takes place in the Red Hook neighborhood, Brooklyn. And the view from the bridge, it's Brooklyn Bridge, of course. And the neighborhood is situated kind of almost under that bridge. Longshoremen and their families live there and work there.
And what year would this be?
This is late 40s, early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And Eddie Carbone, who is the main character, is one of the longshoremen. He has a wife whose name is Beatrice, or Bea. And Beatrice used to have a sister who died and left her daughter, Catherine, to Eddie and Beatrice to raise.
Mm-hmm.
So they're raising the niece. The niece is now about 18. And Eddie is suddenly becoming very protective of her. He doesn't want her to go get a job, you know, although she's training to be a secretary. He's very protective and very kind of selective in terms of where she wants her to work. And on that particular night when the play begins, two of Beatrice's nephews arrive from Italy, from Sicily, as immigrants. Illegal immigrants, as we would say now, to work as longshoremen and, you know, basically to be exploited, and the little money that they're given can be sent back to the families that are starving in Italy, because this is post Second World War Italy, things are dire there.
Yes.
And so here we have these two illegal immigrants, or submarines, as they used to be called then, who are going to get all the work that they need for as long as they're paying those people who brought them here. And once they paid what they owe to the people who arranged papers and made sure that they arrived and received the job, once they paid, of course, then they become like everybody else. Sometimes you get a job, sometimes you don't, right? But Marco, who is the oldest, has a family to feed. And Rodolfo, who is the youngest, is single, and he's doing it because he wants to be in America. Catherine falls in love with Rodolfo. Eddie begins to object. He accuses, at that time it was an accusation, Rodolfo of being a homosexual, of being gay, who just wants to marry Catherine for, you know, the papers, for the passport. He tries to prevent this marriage every way he can. And when he cannot prevent it, ultimately, he makes a phone call to the immigration bureau.
This is a very timely piece.
He didn't know it, so it is an incredibly timely piece, as you realize. Yes. So immigration officers come, they take, you know, both men and two other completely innocent men who just happened to be there, who just arrived on a similar illegal status. And the chorus figure, like Greek chorus, who is a lawyer, Alfieri, is able to actually get the young man out because he is about to get married. But the man who really needs the money, who is supporting his family and sending money home, he's going to be deported.
So he saves Rodolfo.
He saves Rodolfo.
So it doesn't even work.
Marco, yes, Marco is going to be deported. But Marco has every clue that it was Eddie who...
Right.
Told on them.
Right.
And Marco challenges Eddie in front of the entire neighborhood, saying, you know, you told on us.
Right.
You're a rat.
Right.
Eddie cannot live with that. He challenges Marco to a fight. Marco, except his better judgment, accepts. And Eddie dies in that fight in the view of the entire neighborhood.
Wow. And in the first one, saying Catherine.
In
and
the first version, saying Catherine,
right.
Calling his niece's name before
right.
he dies, and the second one calling his wife's name, Beatrice.
Yes.
Right before he dies. Yeah.
So, poor thing.
Mm-hmm.
Driven by passions he's
yeah.
not even aware he has, and yeah, it's a Greek tragedy.
Yeah. Between, you know, that passion for Catherine and that absolute sense of honor where he cannot stand his name being sullied, you know.
Right. Even though it's
even
true.
Even though it is true.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
But he'd better die than live with it.
It'd hardly be more timely. It's a cautionary tale.
That's great.
Thank you so much, Andre.
Thank you.
As always.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
A cautionary tale indeed. And as Andre and I described it, ironically, A View from the Bridge, a play written and produced many, many, many years ago, is appropriate today. Again, The Lynn Show is about saying that it is unfortunately not only possible but often common for us to, for many of us, to be behaving as simply a version of who we are. That is, that for many people, their childhoods require that they hide, pretend to be something less than they are. And if this happened to you, if you think that you had to leave some quality of yourself behind, and you'd like to talk to me about that, please go up on my website, thelynshow.com. That's THELYNNE. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Thelynshow.com. Click on the email tab. Ask me any questions you'd like. I will be happy to hear from you and answer them. And as always, I hope you got something from this show. I hope that you were inspired by Andre's remarkable journey, that you are curious about A View from the Bridge, that you learned something you didn't know, or something you knew but you had forgotten, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten